I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. On October 22, 1962, 50 years ago tonight, President Kennedy addressed the nation, informing them that the Soviet Union was building missile sites in Cuba that were a threat to the United States. He called for a quarantine of offensive military equipment being shipped to Cuba, close surveillance of the island nation, and issued this message to the head of the USSR.
I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man. He has an opportunity now to move the world back from the abyss of destruction. By returning to his government's own words that it had no need to station missiles outside its own territory, and withdrawing these weapons from Cuba, by refraining from any action which will widen or deepen the present crisis, and then by participating in a search for peaceful and permanent solutions.
The crisis was averted, but the real story has not fully been told. While it's been hailed as an example of the U.S. staring down its number one enemy, there were intense, secret, behind-the-scenes negotiations that diffused the crisis. We asked Peter Kornbluth to join us as we mark the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis and what lessons for today's foreign policy crises. He directs the Cuba Documentation Project and the Chile Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. That's a public interest research center at George Washington University, co-author of the project's publication, The Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962. His most recent article, Cuban Missile Crisis at Age 50, Five Decades Later, Lessons Are Still Being Learned from the Most Dangerous Days in History, appears in the November issue of Cigar Aficionado. And Peter Kornbluth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's just a tremendous pleasure to be here on this amazingly historic day.
Indeed it is. And I have to say, I was 13 years old 50 years ago today, and I remember being in my history class, my history teacher, Mr. Neinhertz, talking about what felt like the world on the precipice of World War II. Were you alive back in 50 years ago?
I certainly was. I was not quite as old as you are, I don't really remember anything but my parents being certainly frightened about the situation and keeping us closer around the house at that point. But truth be told, and people who aren't old enough to remember, this was the most chilling speech a president had ever given to the American public in the history of the U.S. presidency. The passages that you just played don't really get to other parts of the speech in which he actually says, we would take no, a victory in a nuclear conflict would be ashes in our mouth. But we do not kind of step back from the risk that portends for us. I mean, it really was a speech in which he laid down a marker, which, frankly, he didn't have to do, but politically felt was necessary for the Soviet Union to take these missiles out of Cuba, or the world would be in danger of a nuclear conflagration.
There were obviously several audiences. One was the American public, and the other audience, I guess, was Khrushchev himself and perhaps even the Russian or the Soviet people.
That's exactly right. We should know the history of this, which is that it was at this moment in this 18-minute speech to the nation that President Kennedy actually told, in a direct sense, the Soviets that he knew those missiles were there, that U.S. intelligence had found them. The text of the speech was given to the Soviet ambassador, Anatoly Dobrynin, just an hour or so before the speech was actually made from the Oval Office. But in that hour, there wasn't enough time in those days to actually get that transmitted back to the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, Khrushchev knew that a speech was coming. He thought that Kennedy was about to announce an invasion of Cuba. So they were very scared there because there were 48,000 Soviet engineers, technicians, and soldiers on the island of Cuba. Kennedy's intelligence community had told him that there were 8,000, but there were many, many more than that. And Khrushchev knew that if the United States attacked Cuba, many of his own soldiers would be killed, and the consequences and the pressure for escalation would be tremendous.
And I do want to go back to the crisis and even the roots of the crisis, but I'm looking at a portion of the speech where Kennedy says, "I want to say a few words to the captive people of Cuba. I speak to you as a friend."
That's a very interesting passage that's in the speech, but you have to know that Kennedy at that point is essentially kind of thinking through his options still of resolving this crisis without violence. And one of the options that's on the table is a secret approach to Castro. And that's one of the things he's considering. But right there, I think he's saying to the Cuban people, in some ways, if you can, rise up and get rid of the government that has put you in this danger. It's not you that we want to attack. It's the people that have brought those missiles to your island.
Well, let's go back 50 years and even before this particular showdown between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. How much did the Bay of Pigs lead to the kind of thinking either in Cuba or even the Soviet Union that there was a need to build these missile sites?
You know, the truth of the matter is that the Cuban Missile Crisis does not begin today on the 22nd of October, nor does it really begin on the 15th of October when the CIA finds evidence of these ballistic missile bases in photo reconnaissance that has just been taken the day before. It really begins at the Bay of Pigs on April 16th, 1961, when Kennedy gives the green light for the CIA to lead a paramilitary invasion of Cuba. That invasion is defeated by Castro's troops. The Kennedys, both John and Robert, are really upset with the U.S. military, with the CIA for misleading them about the prospects of success. Immediately, John Kennedy kind of appoints his brother Robert to become the overseer of new covert operations against Cuba, because he doesn't trust the CIA or the military anymore, which actually turns into to be a plus for the missile crisis. There's a kind of a poetic irony in that the missile crisis is really begun by this ill-fated, perfect failure effort at aggression of the United States towards Cuba, really forcing Cuba to reconsider its own security needs and leaving Castro wide open to accepting a Soviet proposal of a deterrence with ballistic nuclear missiles a year later. But at the same time, the Bay of Pigs is an experience Kennedy goes through, which in some ways teaches him some lessons about listening to his national security advisors when this missile crisis occurs he has found himself with Khrushchev on the brink of nuclear war.
But does Cuba and even the Soviet Union at the time, do they think of these missiles as offensive or defensive back in 1962?
Well, the military definition of offensive and defensive is very different than a national security definition, in a sense. The missiles are offensive if they have a range that can reach another country. And in this case, these medium range and intermediate range ballistic missiles could reach the United States. The medium range ones could reach the southern United States. The intermediate range ballistic missiles could get 2,800 miles into the United States territory. And that defined them as offensive weapons. Mm-hmm. Khrushchev was adamant once they were discovered that he had put the missiles there for defensive purposes, for deterrence purposes. Cuba had already been invaded by the United States in 1961. The Kennedy administration had launched Operation Mongoose in the wake of that defeat, which actually on paper called for another uprising in Cuba and a U.S. invasion. Ironically, the timetable was October of 1962 when that invasion was supposed to come. The Soviets were giving intelligence to Castro, saying they're trying to assassinate you, they're sabotaging you. As you know, they're planning another invasion. We have a solution. You accept these missiles. The missiles, I think, were part of Khrushchev's effort to build a much stronger alliance with Cuba. He really liked Fidel Castro. He liked the Cuban Revolution. It had taken place without any support from the Soviet Union, without any support from the Soviet-backed Communist Party in Cuba. It was an organic communist revolution in Latin America, and he saw a great future for it. But also, he himself was very concerned about U.S. missiles, which were positioned on the Turkish border with the Soviet Union and in Italy, pointed towards the Soviet Union in only a few minutes flying distance. And he wanted to rectify that psychological imbalance in the nuclear equation with the United States by putting these missiles into Cuba. So from his point of view, they were defensive. He had also secretly brought tactical battlefield nuclear weapons to the island of Cuba, and those were clearly defensive. They were there for to defeat an attack on the island itself. But by broader definition, the ballistic missiles themselves were considered, certainly by the United States and by the world, to be offensive weapons.
Kennedy was meeting with some of his advisors, weighing various options, one approaching Castro and Khrushchev, a naval blockade. There was talk also about an air attack and an invasion. Just how seriously was that argued by proponents, the thought of bombing sorties and an invasion of Cuba?
On the very first day of the crisis, in a sense, October 16th, when Kennedy is briefed by the CIA and by McGeorge Bundy in the morning about the existence of these missiles, he gathers a council of wise men, which is called the Executive Committee, the XCOM. We have the history of the meetings of this committee because John F. Kennedy, years before Richard Nixon came along, secretly taped the conversations in the Oval Office. He had a taping system put in after the Bay of Pigs, and we were able eventually, you know, decades after the missile crisis took place, to get these tapes declassified and transcribed, and so we know what happened. We can hear, you know, Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, saying to John Kennedy the morning of October 16th, you know, we have three options on the table to examine now. The first is approach Castro, approach Khrushchev. That was kind of the straightforward diplomatic option. The second one is a naval quarantine around Cuba to stop Soviet ships that may have nuclear weapons on them from reaching the island, and that buys some time to discuss with Khrushchev, you know, how to get those missiles off the island, even though it doesn't force them off the island. And the third option is a surprise airstrike on Cuba, a series of airstrikes, actually, and then an invasion of Cuba so that we can be sure we get all the missiles, even the ones that get hidden in the end. And for the first few days, the focus was on this surprise airstrike and invasion of Cuba, and the plan was to carpet bomb Cuba for 7 days, 500 sorties, 500 bombing raids every day, and then to invade Cuba.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Peter Kornbluh, he directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, and tonight marks the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's speech to the nation about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we're talking about what happened then and its lessons for today. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY is provided by Interact Theater Company, currently celebrating its 25th anniversary season and opening with the National New Play Network rolling world premiere of The Exit Interview by William Missouri Downs. Do things really happen for a reason? This raucous comedy breaks every theater convention in the book in search of an answer. Existentialism and reason collide and rush toward a startling conclusion in this fast-paced comedic look at academia, commercialism, and society. Tickets and information available at interacttheater.org.
I'm Marty Moscoen, host of Radio Times. Thank you so much for making a pledge of support during our fall membership campaign here at WHYY. We asked and you responded. In fact, the response from listeners just like you has been generous and enthusiastic, and we really appreciate it. We will invest your money in the programs that you rely on to keep you informed about all the important issues that face us all, and we'll keep you entertained as well. So thanks again for all that you do to keep WHYY strong.
President Barack Obama and Republican nominee Mitt Romney had several testy exchanges in their last debate.
I had a question, and the question was, how much did you cut them by?
You want me to answer?
How much did you cut them by?
I'm happy to answer the question.
Tonight, they'll share the stage one last time to discuss foreign policy. I'm Mara Liasson. Join us for special coverage of the third presidential debate from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Peter Kornbluh, and we've been talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis 50 years ago this month. And he is, as I said before, he directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. He's written extensively on the Cuban Missile Crisis as an article in the November issue of Cigar Aficionado. I should also add he's been actively involved in the campaign to declassify related government documents. We're talking about what we know and what we are learning about the Cuban Missile Crisis and its lessons for today. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Peter, we were talking about the various options being discussed with President Kennedy and his advisors. And it seemed that Curtis LeMay, the Air Force general, was pretty gung-ho when it came to this notion of carpet bombing and maybe even an invasion.
Yes, Kennedy faced pressure from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and from the generals to simply invade Cuba and basically bomb the hell out of that place. Curtis LeMay wanted the green light right away. And when Kennedy basically hinted that he was kind of leaning towards a quarantine option, because that would give some time for diplomacy, LeMay basically challenged him in front of all of his advisors. He said, "Well, you're looking at a Munich type of solution, in other words, appeasement, which was the ultimate insult to John F. Kennedy because his father had been ambassador to England during the Munich meetings and had been widely accused of supporting the appeasement of Hitler." And Kennedy actually has an exchange with General LeMay about the whole issue of winning a nuclear war, and he basically says, "You know, General, if the missiles fly, 70 million Americans could be killed. You're talking about the destruction of a country." And I think one of the most poignant moments on this first day of deliberations about the options of response to finding the missiles is Robert McNamara saying to the president and his advisors, I don't know quite what kind of world we face if we attack Cuba. You know, what do the Soviets do next? How do we stop it at that point?" And this was the question that the president grappled with. In a nuclear era, if he attacked Cuba, killed Soviet personnel, and I should say, McNamara says to him, "You'll end up killing, you know, 300 or 400 Soviet personnel." In truth, these massive attacks probably would have killed upward of 40,000 Soviet soldiers and technicians and engineers. And that's a lot. But basically, the point is, Khrushchev's going to have to respond. He may attack Berlin. And we just do not know how this thing gets contained and doesn't escalate into full-scale nuclear war. And that's the question that Kennedy grappled with. And throughout these 13 days, as the crisis is defined from the 16th of October to the 28th of October, and Khrushchev agrees to withdraw the missiles, behind the scenes, you see Kennedy actively pursuing a kind of creative back-channel diplomacy. He pursues it by authorizing a secret approach to Fidel Castro. That was one of the deepest secrets of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It wasn't discovered until more than four decades later by an intrepid George Washington University historian, James Hershberg. Even today, we're learning more about it from the papers of Robert Kennedy, which have just been released at the Kennedy Library. But he also tells his brother secretly to go ahead and tell the Soviets that secretly the United States will swap our missiles in Turkey for the missiles in Cuba. And he sends a message secretly to the United Nations saying, basically, "We may need you to propose this swap yourself. I can't politically take the initiative to do this, but if the United Nations proposes this trade, I commit to agreeing to it." All of these things to avoid attacking Cuba and opening the Pandora's box in the nuclear age to violence between the superpowers.
My understanding is that Curtis LeMay was the inspiration for Dr. Strangelove. It certainly fits.
yes, he was the cigar-chomping model for the famous character in Dr. Strangelove, one of the first kind of cultural markers of how insane the situation was, in which men like Kennedy and Khrushchev had their fingers on the button of worldwide destruction.
So how close, and I do remember very, very well, quite vividly, these Soviet ships making their way to Cuba. And I know that Secretary Rush talked about, you know, being eyeball to eyeball when it came to this showdown over whether these materials were going to be delivered to Cuba or not. Just how close were those ships to each other?
The truth is that Dean Rusk's famous statement, eyeball to eyeball, where he says on October 24th, the CIA has just come in and said the Soviet ships that we've been watching, that we think have nuclear equipment on them, have approached the quarantine line. They've stopped in the waters. They're going to turn around. And Dean Rusk says, we were eyeball to eyeball, and I think the other side, the other guy, just blinked. And that became the iconic representation of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The United States played a game of chicken with the Soviets. The Soviets swerved, retreated, surrendered. And so that's a very, very important statement. Let me just tell you, it's not right because the intelligence that was handed to Rusk and Kennedy and his advisors at that moment that caused Rusk to say this was incorrect, as so many intelligence failures we know from the whole invasion of Iraq and the search for weapons of mass destruction there. You know, that the intelligence community doesn't get it right all the time. And this was no laughing matter, though. And the truth is that Khrushchev had turned those two ships around a day and a half earlier. This was only recently discovered by an investigative reporter for the Washington Post, Michael Dobbs, who wrote a brilliant book called 1 Minute to Midnight on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he went back and looked at the intelligence on where those ships were. And it turns out that at the very moment that Rusk said this, those ships were 500 miles and 800 miles, the two of them, away from the quarantine line and returning to the Soviet Union, because Khrushchev had turned them around immediately after Kennedy's speech on the night of the 22nd to avoid any conflict on the high seas with the United States and those ships. So that was a mistake. That never really happened. But that image of the solution to the missile crisis lived on for years and years and years. And it was only now, really, on the 50th anniversary, that kind of the mainstream media and a political discussion of the lessons of the missile crisis is taking place in a broader context, which is redefining what really happened. And what really happened is not that we stared down the Soviets and they blinked and surrendered and retreated, and we were forceful and they were weak. What really happened is that Kennedy engaged, as did Khrushchev, in creative back-channel diplomacy with a commitment to get the hell out of the knot, to untie this tight knot that they two of them had tied around the world, and avoid a conflagration. And it's really compromise, accommodation, and negotiation that are the lessons of the missile crisis. And if you can imagine, if the secrecy had not surrounded the solution to the crisis for all these years, we might have had a kind of a redefinition of what it means to be a prudent foreign policymaker. And the words negotiation, compromise, accommodation wouldn't have a pejorative value. They wouldn't be tied to weakness and surrender as they seem to be now in the lexicon of foreign policy dialogue. They would be compliments to leaders that use those techniques to advance the national security of the entire world.
But it is interesting to hear the strong language coming from Kennedy, the public pronouncements, and knowing, as you said, that he had sent his brother, Robert Kennedy, to deliver a message to the Soviet ambassador. President Kennedy had approached the United Nations, had approached Castro himself. So it's interesting to...
Secretly.
Secretly. I realize that that's the operative word here. But it is interesting that you've got these strong pronouncements that are made publicly and secret behind the scenes negotiations. Even Khrushchev saying when told that he was actually meeting with the president of Westinghouse in Moscow, which is interesting in and of itself, saying, but if you want to meet us all in hell, it's up to you.
Well, that was on the 24th of October, just a day and a half after Kennedy's speech. And Khrushchev just happens to have a meeting with the president of Westinghouse, who's in Moscow at the time, and they discuss this issue. And Khrushchev basically says, if you attack Cuba, you know, Guantanamo base is going to be obliterated the next day. The Soviets had been position tactical nuclear weapons at the front door of the U.S. base at Guantanamo in preparation for a pending U.S. attack. But he also says, you know, I'm putting these missiles on Cuba for defensive reasons. And if you want to attack Cuba and we'll all meet in hell, you know,
bring it
on. bring it on. But he also says, but those missiles are not there to threaten you. They are there to protect Cuba from you. And, you know, we really should get into some of the lessons of the missile crisis here. And one of the lessons is that small countries will defend themselves. Cuba felt threatened. They had a relationship with the Soviet Union in which they could hopefully obtain the ultimate defensive weapon. There was nothing against international law. International law supported Khrushchev's position that he could put missiles into Cuba, but he did it secretly because he believed that Kennedy politically would not be able to tolerate an open deployment of these missiles in Cuba, even though the Soviets had been forced to tolerate the deployment of U.S. missiles on the Turkish border and in Italy. And at that Westinghouse, at that meeting with the president of Westinghouse, Khrushchev tells the story, which he used to tell often, which is he tells the president of Westinghouse that the Soviet Union has had to live like a man in a house with a smelly goat for years, and now the United States would know what it was like to live in a house with a smelly goat as well, the goat being, of course, the threat of these missiles along their border.
Well, it was the height of the Cold War, was it not?
It was the height of the Cold War, but this is a crisis that still gives us pause, and the lessons from it are even more important because it was the height of the Cold War. And as Arthur Schlesinger put it when I organized a conference in Cuba for the 40th anniversary of the missile crisis, and he and Robert McNamara and Ted Sorensen, all of whom aren't here today to discuss the 50th anniversary with us. But as Schlesinger put it at the time, you know, this was not only the most dangerous moment in Cold War history, this was the most dangerous moment in the history of humankind.
Mm. And that's Peter Kornbluh. He directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive and has written extensively about the Cuban Missile Crisis, our topic for today's Radio Times. You can give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And I do want to talk about the lessons for today because I think they're important and bears discussion, certainly because we have a foreign policy debate tonight between President Obama and Governor Romney. But why do you think the Kennedy administration sort of buyed into this mythology that it was us staring down the Soviets rather than talking more openly about the kind of diplomacy and negotiations that really diffused the crisis?
Well, you know, when you deal with conflict, and this is why understanding the real lessons of the crisis is so important. In the history of U.S. foreign policy, the United States has seen itself and been and leaders have been rewarded politically for being kind of macho and muscular leaders. The United States stands tall. We're proud. We're strong. We are the best, and we defeat the rest of the world. Of course, that's not what really happens in the real world. And it's perhaps not what really should happen in the real world. It has led to a lot of abuses of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. power around the world. But Kennedy understood that he would be rewarded politically for appearing to be strong and staring the Russians down. And his team started to spin the crisis management of the crisis of what had happened in the press pretty soon after the crisis was resolved, and they painted Kennedy as the resolute president who had stood firm, who had used calibrated strength and power to force the Soviets to reconsider. Publicly, the world understood that the crisis had ended because the United States had made a vague public commitment not to invade Cuba in the future. Mm. And Khrushchev had pledged to withdraw the missiles and never to deploy offensive weapons in the Western Hemisphere again. And that was the public understanding of the deal. But the real deal was a secret deal to swap the U.S. missiles that were in Turkey, pointed at the Soviet Union, for the missiles in Cuba. And the public didn't know about that, and the Kennedy administration made a great effort to keep that secret. At one point, when Khrushchev actually sent a letter through his ambassador, Dobrynin, for the Kennedys, kind of laying out how this agreement would be implemented in the following months, and had a whole section on the missile swap, the White House looked at the letter, resealed it, and returned it to the Soviet embassy, supposedly unopened, basically with the kind of implicit message, we are not going to talk about this part of the deal. We're not going to put anything on paper. It is top secret. And the Soviets, kept it secret. They'd been asked to keep it secret, and they kept it secret. And so it didn't, this kind of part of the deal didn't emerge for close to three decades in kind of a confirmable historical way for those of us to look at this issue and learn the lessons.
You say it's better to think, or maybe more accurate to think, of President Kennedy not as a resolute president, although I'm sure he was, but as a resolution president.
Thank you for quoting that.
That's
that
you,
line
Peter
Kornbluh. In the Cigar Aficionado article. That is the operative issue here, is that as the record of the missile crisis has been declassified and analyzed and aired through conferences and documents over these last particularly 20 years, the image of Kennedy has moved from a resolute president, which he painted himself and his aides painted him publicly in the aftermath of the missile crisis, to the resolution president, a president who behind the scenes was committed to finding a resolution without using violence, without attacking Cuba. And let me just tell you,
sure,
on the most dangerous day of the crisis, October 27th, which we could spend the rest of the time discussing, Khrushchev has now made a public demand that the missiles be swapped from Turkey and Cuba. And Kennedy's aides and Kennedy are discussing this in the Oval Office, and the taping system is rolling and picking up everybody's position. And all of his aides, almost every single one, has taken the position that he cannot make this swap, that it's going to hurt the NATO alliance, that it's going to look like he was weak and yielded to nuclear blackmail. Again, the weakness argument. And Kennedy, I think, a moment arrives in which I really think is extraordinary, where he says to his aides, you know, it sounds good for us to reject this proposal now, but what is it going to sound like after we've attacked Cuba, the Soviets have grabbed Berlin, the blood has flown, and people have lost their courage? What are people going to say then? They're going to come to me and they're going to say, you know, that proposal to swap those old missiles in Turkey for the Soviet missiles in Cuba looks pretty good now. He says to his aides, it sounds great to reject this proposal now, but it is not going to after we've done something. And so he's thought down the line, and he's come to the conclusion on his own that he has to use diplomacy to resolve this crisis, not force.
And that's Peter Kornbluh, our guest today on Radio Times. He directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, has written extensively on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we are marking the 50th anniversary. Lessons learned and unlearned. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener University supports WHYY and offers graduate degree programs including hospitality and tourism, human sexuality, physical therapy, social work, and more, giving students hands-on leadership experience designed to help advance careers in today's challenging economy. Widener's next open house is on Tuesday, October 23rd from 5 to 7 p.m. More online at widener.edu. Widener University. Widener Leadership Works.
Vulnerability is not weakness. According to Brené Brown, author of Daring Greatly, vulnerability is the only way we can have truly intimate, honest relationships. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, Brené Brown talks about the gifts of vulnerability. today at noon here on WHYY FM.
Medford Lees, a not-for-profit community serving those ages 55-plus and guided by Quaker principles, supports WHYY. This fall, there's an opportunity to explore, learn, and discover with Medford Lees as they launch their new Pathways series. Pathways features public programming on topics covering art, politics, music, history, horticulture, and more. Full details about Medford Lees public events, educational programming, and its campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, are online at medfordlees.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. For 13 days in October 1962, the U.S. and the Soviet Union faced off over missile sites in Cuba. Many were concerned that the conflict would lead to a nuclear war between the two superpowers. We've learned a lot more about the Cuban Missile Crisis in the last half century. Most importantly, the role of behind-the-scenes diplomacy that diffused the showdown. Talking with Peter Kornbluh about what happened 50 years ago and the lessons for today. You can read an article that he wrote in the November issue of Cigar Aficionado. It's titled Cuban Missile Crisis at Age 50, Five Decades Later, Lessons Are Still Being Learned from the Most Dangerous Days in History. You can also give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Of course, every crisis has its own unique features, but even going back to the invasion of Iraq after September 11th. Do you see some parallels between Iraq and this Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, there are some parallels that have to do, again, with smaller countries seeking to defend themselves. The issue for Iraq was, of course, that President George Bush tried to appropriate what he claimed was the lessons of the Cuban Missile Crisis and invoke them to support a preemptive strike on Saddam Hussein and the purported weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And he actually took some of Kennedy's words from the very speech that you played at the beginning of this program and quoted them in his opening speech to basically lay the groundwork for a U.S. invasion of Iraq. And we happened to be in Cuba for the 40th anniversary of the missile crisis at that very moment. I and Brown University and the Cuban universities had organized a major international conference. We had brought the surviving members of the Kennedy White House, the Soviet generals and diplomats who were still alive, who were part of the crisis, and Fidel Castro and his top aides all came as well. And we brought the declassified documentary record from all three countries to examine. And Ted Sorensen, who had actually written the very words in 1962 that George Bush was now citing to justify a preemptive strike on Iraq, basically told the press, you know, those words were not written to justify a preemptive strike because President Kennedy had ruled out a preemptive strike, or he was trying to figure out a way to avoid a preemptive strike rather than go forward with one. And Arthur Schlesinger said, if President Bush was my student, I'd flunk him in history.
Wow.
And so you have a situation in which the lessons of the crisis were being misappropriated. Once again, even today on the issue of Iran, you have Benjamin Netanyahu saying that the United States should draw a red line on Iran's nuclear program, just like John Kennedy drew a red line on the Soviets putting missiles in Cuba. But the lesson of the Cuban Missile Crisis is that a preemptive strike should be avoided at all costs in a nuclear world, because the violence that can be opened with a preemptive strike is too dangerous. And that is the debate that's going on right now over Israeli foreign policy and U.S. foreign policy towards Iran, whether an attack on Iran will just make things worse and the world more dangerous and the Middle East more dangerous and Iran eventually more dangerous rather than extended diplomacy. I was at a function at the Kennedy Library just a week ago, and the dean of kind of analysis on the Cuban Missile Crisis, Graham Allison, said that the Iran conflict is kind of a Cuban Missile Crisis in slow motion, in the sense that we have months and perhaps even years of a back channel and secret effort or open effort to negotiate some kind of solution. And that process is kind of in motion now. Kennedy had 13 days. But I think what's interesting is that tonight you're going to hear, I would predict, Mitt Romney attacking President Obama for appearing to be weak and appeasing Iran by reportedly engaging in back-channel diplomacy and trying to find a way to have direct talks with Iran. He's going to take the more forceful road because he thinks that that will get him more votes for standing up strong. Romney's going to argue that the more forceful road, you know, threatening and using force against Iran is the better option, and that's what he'll do when he's president. If the real lessons of the missile crisis had been incorporated all these decades into the lexicon of foreign policy, the issue of dialogue and negotiation and accommodation and finding a way out wouldn't be insults. Those would be compliments to the wisdom of foreign policymakers.
Well, and I wonder, too, whether one of the, and then we'll get to our callers, one of the lessons is that you have to figure out how to give the other side a way out so that it becomes, at least the perception for the other side is that it is a win-win.
Well, that's right. And you have countries like Cuba, like Iran, who feel threatened. And the issue is how you come to some place in the international community in which these countries feel their security is safeguarded without these weapon systems in place. And that's a very difficult nut to crack, obviously, with a country like Iran and the threats against Israel. It's not an easy thing, but it is so much more important to pursue diplomacy rather than risk violence in a nuclear world. And that's what John Kennedy understood, and that's what the real lesson of the missile crisis is.
Even reliving some of this history, some of your reading and writing, I should say, and others as well, is that there were some really close calls. For instance, a U-2 plane is shot down over Cuba. This that October 27th, a U-2 strays into Soviet airspace near Alaska. There was a U.S. ship that thought a submarine or a Soviet sub was a threat, and the Soviet sub thought that the World War had actually already started.
And that Soviet sub had a nuclear-tipped torpedo, and the captain had orders to fire his weapons rather than surface and surrender.
Wow.
And so that actual confrontation on the high seas, which we didn't really learn about until only 10 years ago, when one of the Soviet personnel on that submarine came to this conference in Cuba, and along with an American naval officer who'd been on the U.S. destroyer above this submarine, dropping depth charges onto the submarine, the two of them told the story together for the first time of
Wow.
what happened. And that probably was the most dangerous moment because that sub was essentially crippled. The air conditioning had gone off. It was dark. It was just nobody had been able to sleep down there. And the captain could not communicate with Moscow, had no instructions, and he really came close to loading that missile and firing it and starting the first use of nuclear weapons. But the point is that there's two points here. One is, all these years later, we're still learning more things about the missile crisis. And really, it's a crisis of such magnitude that we should have every scrap of paper on it declassified and available for public scrutiny so the full consequences, lessons, history is completely understood.
And who's sitting on all these documents, all this information?
Well, all three governments still have secret documents. The United States still has intelligence records that are secret. Russia has archives, which were briefly opened in the early 1990s and have yielded some wonderful material, including some new material that my colleague Svetlana Savronskaya has used in a brand new book about the Soviets' own missile crisis in Cuba in November that is just hitting the stands today. And of course, the Cubans have declassified some documents for these conferences that we've held, but they have an even bigger archive that hasn't been seen by the rest of the world. And there are many other countries that were former members of the Soviet bloc and Latin American countries that were involved that also have documents. So there's more to learn, and it's imperative that we learn it. But the second thing, of course, is that you see from the discussion of the Soviet submarines is that this is a crisis that got out of control. The idea that you can manage crises in a nuclear world is a mistake. And this was the lesson that Robert McNamara was really pushing before he died, and that is that there's so many miscalculations, errors, mistakes conflicts. When they're conventional conflicts, they cost many, many lives. But when they're nuclear-related conflicts, they can cost the destruction of the world. And his conclusion was that the key lesson of the missile crisis is that we should work towards the eventual elimination of all nuclear weapons from the face of the earth, because there's just too much danger when they're present and in the hands of leaders. Mm.
Powerful words today. Let me get to Linda from Birdsboro. Then I do want to play a clip of President Kennedy speaking with President Eisenhower. But first, let's get Linda from Birdsboro to join us. And Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Both of you. Thanks for the program.
You're welcome.
I was in kindergarten and living in New York City when this happened. And my mom worked at the UN. She was a transcriptionist, spoke French, Italian, Spanish, German, the Western European languages. And I remember being drilled. I went to a girls' school on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and drilling air raid drills over and over and over again, day after day after day. We did them once a month before that. But I remember teachers arguing, well, when the blast comes, if they're right under the glass may fall on them. No, no, no. If they're under the glass will blow over them. And I remember my mother coming home, and the news was on constantly. And I was asking my mother, "What's going on?" Everyone says that you know, and I'm in kindergarten. And I don't even understand I don't understand anything outside New York City. My mother explained to me there are missiles on an island, and somebody may. And I'm sure she had explained what a missile was. She said they're like bombs. It's just very bad, and they're aimed probably at us. And I said, at us in New York? She said, yes.
That's
I think
scary.
We would be, if they're strong enough to get here, they would want to attack New York. And I remember saying to her, why? And she says, I really don't know. And my mother saying, and I just said to my mother, what would it be like? And she said, we'll probably be vaporized. She goes, and I said, are we going to go? She goes, there's nowhere for us to go. My mother was a single parent. And so I remember talking with kids who had parents that worked at the UN, and they were all like, well, we won't suffer. We'll just be vaporized. And these are like little kindergarten kids. And
yeah,
we're
no,
and
those were stressful times,
yeah.
Linda. Let me give Peter Kornbluh a chance to weigh in. Peter, you might have been closer to the same age as Linda.
I was approximately, I was in kindergarten also, and I think that's just a great description. You'd really have to go back to that moment and look at the headlines and the protests by both peace groups and other more forceful anti-communist groups trying to influence how Kennedy handled this. He had other options. He didn't have to draw the line right then and say you have to get those missiles out or risk nuclear war. He could have said, we'll accept these missiles like the Soviets have accepted those in Turkey. But he, as he's heard saying to his brother on tape, you know, I would be impeached if I didn't do anything. And that's probably true. It certainly would have been a tumultuous political time for him. That was the nature of politics during the Cold War, but it's still the nature of politics today, well beyond the Cold War. So we still have a situation in which leaders can box themselves in to the use of aggression or taking at least a threatening posture in a situation like this. And that's what makes it so very dangerous. But it is so important to recall how scary it truly was. I was at the Kennedy Library. I happened to be the first person to be able to look at the release of the new Robert Kennedy papers about 10 days ago. And there is his handwritten notes from a meeting on October 27th, which is the day known as Black Saturday. And they are discussing that very issue that we just talked about. There was a submarine. The president is being told that it's positioned itself near the quarantine line. A U.S. destroyer is going to try and make it surface. And there's this kind of tension that comes over the room. And Robert Kennedy jots down in his handwritten notes, you know, I looked across the table at the president. His eyes were tense, almost gray. Were we facing the moment of a Holocaust? Had we done something wrong? He writes, I feel like we were on a precipice and there was no way to get off. And in fact, there was a way to get off and at that point, and Kennedy and Khrushchev found it through a secret compromise. And that's why we're here today.
Indeed,
to
it
discuss
is.
This history.
Well, but let me also play a taped conversation between Presidents Kennedy and Eisenhower during this 13-day crisis. Let's listen.
General, what about if the Soviet Union Khrushchev announces tomorrow, which I think he will, that if we attack Cuba, that it's going to be nuclear war? And what's your judgment as to the chances they'll fire these things off if we invade Cuba?
I don't believe that
they will. Yeah, they will. In other words, you would take that risk if the situation seems
odd. As a matter of fact, though, what can you do? If this thing is such a serious thing here on our flank that we're going to be uneasy, and we know what this thing's happening now, all right, you've got to use something.
Right.
Something may make these people shoot them off. I just don't believe this will.
Yeah, all right.
Well, in any event, of course, I'll say this. I'd want to keep my own people very alert.
Yeah. No, hang on tight.
Yes, sir.
Thanks a lot, General.
All right, thanks.
Peter, we're almost out of time here, but I've always just been fascinated by those off-the-record conversations between former presidents. Your thoughts?
Well, it's great that we have that to listen to. I think most people will think that there's some levity going on there, but that's just letting off the tension. Of course, the President of the United States, the young President of the United States, is consulting with the famous general who was his predecessor, General Eisenhower, in terms of his own thinking about how the enemy will respond. But this is one of the things. He listens to Eisenhower, but then Kennedy takes his own counsel in the end, and he really goes out of his way. And I mean, out of his way. He overrules all of his advisors, essentially, makes this secret trade, even then sends a message to the United Nations as Plan B. And it's just very important to remember that that was the resolution of the missile crisis, not the use of force, the use of diplomacy.
Well, Peter Kornbluh, thank you so much for joining us at Today in Radio Times to talk about this important piece of history.
It's a pleasure on this historic day.
Indeed. And he directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. And he has an article, actually, in the November edition of Cigar Aficionado, Cuban Missile Crisis at Age 50. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us, though. We'll be right back.